the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we talk about how we make our world more just and more compassionate. We call it Just Love because if we just love God, we love our neighbor, we love ourselves, then our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. And we talk with those people who think about, who write about, who teach about, who do those things which do affect our public policies and how we view the world. And certainly in this time, it really appears that politics almost has been turned up and down on its head, not only in the United States, but across the globe. And boy, those of us who are, as we sometimes refer to ourselves, the ex-colonials in the United States, who had a Tea Party a number of years ago and no longer were part of the British Empire some 200 or so years ago, kind of we paid pretty close attention that Britain's recent decision to leave the European Union, and we felt its effects throughout the world in the United States. Those who have 401ks, 403bs, those who have IRAs and all of those type of things that are kind of maybe saving for their retirement, you know, notice that the stock market took a downturn right after Britain decided to leave the economic or the European Union. And so that's a really, really kind of significant issue, not merely for Britain, the United Kingdom, but for the rest of the world. So today on Just Love, we're going to hear from Rutgers professor Dan Kellerman about what that Brexit means. I got to tell you, Tom, one of the things I want to do, I want in my next life, I want to be the person who writes all of those names and all of those headlines like Brexit and stuff like that. So I think those are neat. So we're going to speak with him. And then we're going to kind of talk about, you know, just the global issues about how chaotic politics seems to be. And, you know, in the United States, everybody is commenting on how this election cycle is so different than the others. And so we're going to talk about that. And so I'm delighted that we're going to speak about those issues as we kind of are in the lead up to 4th of July, Independence Day. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting show, and it's going to give us things to think about as we kind of celebrate the day of American kind of independence. So, Tom, you got any news that you want to share with our listeners before we go to our first guest?
I do, Monsieur. You know, I mean, we have a little bit of good news. You know, this past week on Thursday, June 23rd, negotiators in Havana, Cuba, who were working with the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, also popularly known as the FARC, have been negotiating for 3 years to try to end what is the longest insurgency in the New World, Monsignor. I mean, as I know you're aware, many listeners may be aware, but perhaps not. For 50 years, there's been war in Colombia. Over 220,000 people have been killed and millions displaced. But the good news is on
What's the war about?
The war, I think, is between the Colombian president and the Colombian leaders and the FARC rebel movement, who tend to be a Marxist rebel movement, Monsignor. I think they're predominantly out in the mountains, and they're fighting in order to be able to establish a Marxist republic down in Colombia. And so this has been going on for 50 years. And it's
what happened this week?
Well, this week, the great news is that on Thursday, June 23rd, they announced that a ceasefire has been signed by the Colombian government and by the FARC insurgency, their representatives, that's going to bring an end to this 50-year war, frankly. And the announcement said that there would be a commitment of rebels to lay down their arms within 180 days of when a final peace deal is reached. There's going to be a creation of temporary transition zones and camps for the estimated 7,000 rebels that are still up in the mountains. So there'll be places where they can go. There's also provisions that no civilians will be allowed to enter the FARC camps, but then at the same time, so the FARC will not be able to obviously recruit people, but at the same time, there's going to be a guarantee the rebels will have their security provided, and then the United Nations, Monsieur, is going to be involved too. They're going to have monitors there that are going to be able to kind of assert that the FARC has wound up putting down their weapons. So it's estimated that probably within the next 2 months or so that the ceasefire will be official. It'll be officially signed by the president and by the leaders of the FARC. And then I think we can start hopefully seeing some peace in a part of the world that really has seen fighting for 50 years.
Was how many people were killed last year?
Last year, I don't have, Monsignor. I know the total number of deaths is 220,000 over the 50 years. And as you may, as I know you're aware, millions have been displaced in this. You know, a lot of times when we end up talking about internally displaced persons.
Does the FARC have anything to do with the drugs there?
Yes, I think they are somewhat involved with the drugs as well.
Okay. All right. Good. Any other news you got?
I do. Well, you know, we're going to be talking about the Brexit, and it's sort of interesting how on this side of the pond, I would say, as it were, there is some talk amongst folks that they themselves are kind of inspired a little bit by the fact that Britain has wound up leaving the European Union, or voting to leave the European Union. They actually haven't left yet. So a number of places have actually toyed with this. One of them, Monsignor, is just this past month, earlier in May, actually on May 13th, the Texas Republican Convention actually floated a proposal for Texas to wind up leaving the Union. It was actually voted down, thank goodness.
I think
that
happened like a century ago.
It did, actually, which is sort of funny. It actually is illegal, Monsignor, as you know, for states to wind up leaving the Union. That was kind of handled at the courthouse at Appomattox about 150 years ago. But these movements are still high up, and the people are still wind up talking about them. And in fact, here in New York, we have had some movement here for our own Staten Island. They've talked at some point about breaking off from New York City. Back in 1993, actually, there was a vote that sort of said that some Staten Islanders were interested in breaking off in the city. And now some people are starting to resurrect that talk, too. So I think that the Brexit has inspired people on both sides of the pond to talk about breaking away. So I think it's an important conversation we're going to have today.
I don't. I think it's a waste of time. I think it's a waste of time. A lot of the talk about these things, which are kind of done pretty much for the sake of kind of gaining political popularity and to shore up some type of base. There are very serious public policy issues that need to be discussed, and I think some of these are just a distraction. Obviously, there are important issues like the one in the European Union when they have real potential, or as it was a number of years ago when Scotland voted. Those are real things. But these distractions that kind of just are there to gain media attention, it seems to me, is pretty irresponsible to kind of put those things forward. But having said that, I would like to go to our first guest, who is Daniel Kellerman, who teaches at Rutgers University. And we're going to talk to him about that important issue of the exit of the United Kingdom from the European Union. Professor Kellerman, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great. I, in the work I do at Catholic Charities, we go usually once a year to kind of have a breakfast, which is a little bit of a fundraising breakfast at the New York Stock Exchange. And we had it on just a few days ago on Monday of this week. And everybody there was talking about the leaving of the United Kingdom from the European Union. So tell us what happened. Why did just tell us, first of all, what happened? And now we're hearing that it happened, but it's going to take a while to do, and they don't even know how to do it. So give us a little bit of a primer so I can get a little bit smarter and our listeners can get a little bit smarter.
All right. Well, I'll do my best for you. It's a long story and a bit of a tragic one, I think. But I think the first thing, if you want to start really at the beginning, the thing to understand is that the UK's relationship with the European Union has always been a fraught one, right?
Right.
So the European Union had different names over time, started as European Economic Community, later became a European Community, and then a Union as it strengthened. But from the very beginning, the UK's position was sort of 1 foot in, 1 foot out. So at the beginning, when the European
Professor Kellerman, I'm old enough, and I remember where in that history does the term common market come from?
Well, yeah, because if you go back to when the European Economic Community was formed in 1957-58, then it was basically a common market.
Okay,
so in Britain, they referred to it as the common market, right?
Okay, got it.
And they did not join at that time. The UK did not join the common market when it was first formed. It was six countries on the continent, and they stayed out. But then they decided to join in the early 70s and 73. And then no sooner had they joined than they had second thoughts, and they held their first referendum on membership in 75, right?
Okay.
And at that time, there was a big vote, around two-thirds, to stay in.
Okay.
So that seemed like it had settled the issue. But then even by the 80s, under Thatcher, doubts began to be expressed in the Conservative Party, because basically this common market, as you said, was taking on new responsibilities and new powers that the member governments had agreed to. That's true, but still some people had doubts. And basically from the 90s up to the present, really, the UK has been taking steps back. As this project of uniting Europe has advanced, the UK had been pulling away for years, really, before this Brexit vote. So, for instance, the UK opted out of participating in the common currency, the euro, right?
Okay.
So they're not part of the euro. They opted out of the borderless free movement zone within Europe called Schengen, right?
Okay.
And so they were already sort of halfway in, halfway out. And then just to fast forward to what set up this Brexit vote was that essentially the Conservative Party, sometimes called the Tories, were really divided on this issue, where a big wing of the party wanted the UK out of the EU, and then you had this new party called UKIP, which is a kind of far-right party that's anti-EU, advocating withdrawal of the UK from the EU. They were gaining votes, and so David Cameron, the Prime Minister, was worried, right? And so then he said, okay, well, we'll settle this issue by putting it to the voters, thinking that that would stave off the rise of UKIP, and that would
so
try
Professor,
to heal the
Professor
rift
Kellerman,
in his party.
Professor Kellerman, so let me ask you the question. So
yeah. It
was David Cameron's decision to hold a referendum. Is that authority kind of given to the Prime Minister to decide if when not to hold a referendum?
Yeah, because the referendum, in any case, has no legally binding effect. It's what's called a consultative referendum. Now, politically, it would be sort of suicidal to ignore the result once the people have spoken, right? But
well,
organize a referendum on any question.
Professor Kellerman, but what's the difference between suicide or homicide? David Cameron resigned when he lost, so if he stayed in and didn't abide by it, he would have got a vote now.
No, that's true, but I guess I have, he's in any case finished, but that applies more to the next leader, whoever takes over, the next prime minister, because some people are speculating, by the way, maybe Brexit will never happen now that a lot of the costs are becoming apparent. Maybe they'll find some way to fudge and stay in. But I think any new leader, new prime minister who tried to say, well, we're going to sort of ignore the results or try a do-over second referendum, I think they would also find themselves quickly out, right, the way Cameron has. But yeah,
So if it's advisory, and I get what you're saying, it really shouldn't be ignored. There's got to be, I guess, some further actual deliberative and determinative vote taken to actually leave.
Well, that is a good question, and
you're the lawyer.
It's a bit ambiguous because. Here's what the EU says, right?
Okay.
The EU treaties, and you mentioned the U.S. and talked about leaving, by the way, and there's an interesting comparison where, as you rightly pointed out, U.S. states cannot leave, right? That was settled in the Civil War. That's illegal, right? The EU, by contrast, there's a provision in the treaties called Article 50 that sets out the procedure for any state to leave. So it's voluntary. It's not something forced on countries, right?
Okay.
But that provision says, any state can leave according to its own domestic constitutional arrangements for, and then it has to notify the EU formally of its intention to withdraw. So there's two things then. The UK doesn't have a written constitution, so there's some argument. Does Parliament have to approve Brexit in a vote in Parliament, or can the Prime Minister simply send a letter to Brussels? People are arguing about that right now. But in any case, from the EU's point of view, they say this only kicks off when you send us a formal notification of your intent to withdraw, and they say they want that letter ASAP.
Okay. Now, because the other thing I've heard is, and I guess this gives me a little bit of an insight into why people are saying it, people in Scotland are saying, well, you can't do it unless our parliament votes in favor of it. And I guess that's what they're interpreting the ambiguity as, giving them the right to block it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question also. And let me just say before I answer that, that you know, a lot of people are talking about, oh, this Brexit may pull apart and lead to disintegration of the whole European Union. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think if there's any union that's really threatened by Brexit, it's more the British Union, you know, the union of England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, that's the one in real trouble. Because as you say, leaders of Scotland, the Scottish National Party, and then some Sinn Féin officials in Northern Ireland are saying because majorities in Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to stay in the EU, they're saying it would be illegitimate, right, for the rest of the UK, England and Wales, to drag them out of the EU against the will of their people.
Ah,
and,
pretty good.
And as you say, the Scottish, their position is that they say that the act, the Scotland Act that devolved power down to Scotland and gave them their own, you know, Scottish Parliament, etc., that says that if you change the terms, basically, of you know, Scotland's relations with the EU, I'm sort of simplifying here, that you know, Scotland would have to have to give its consent, right?
Ah.
So they claim they have the authority to block Brexit, but ultimately, you know, in the British system, if Westminster wanted to pass a new law, kind of changing that, you know, they could. But there's going to be a big backlash from Scotland if they try to force the issue on them.
We're speaking with Professor Daniel Kilman, who is at Rutgers University, and we're speaking about the UK's, United Kingdom's leaving of the European Union. And we've talked a little bit about kind of the technical politics of it and what the vote means and all of those type of things. What I'd like to move to now, Professor Kilman, so, okay, at the end of the day, it's all about economics. So what, and I know the right answer to this is who knows, but I'm not letting you get away with that. So what's your kind of best estimate as the economic impact of this pulling out? Let's assume they actually do pull out sometime in the next 6 months or year. What's the economic impact of this?
All right. Well, I'll tell you about the economic impact, but I would like to push back on one thing you say. I don't think it is just all about economics, because there's a profound political aspect to this, too, about this sort of project of trying to unite Europe. But let's go first to the economics, right?
Right.
I think, as you say, estimates vary. But in any case, this is going to be very bad for the British economy in the short to medium term, at least. And then somewhat bad for the whole of the Eurozone or, you know, EU economy. So for the British economy, the worst case scenarios are that, you know, Britain is pushed into a recession in the coming year. Even those who don't predict recession think that growth, which was going around 2% GDP growth, that'll be pushed down, maybe cut in half, right? So it's going to affect growth and jobs in the UK. And part of the reason it's really going to affect investment into the UK, you know, a lot of international investment, including from the U.S., but also from around the world, goes into the U.K. in part because the U.K. is a nice beachhead for then accessing the whole European market of 500 million people, right? So they can set up businesses in the U.K. and have access to that common market. But depending on what sort of relationship they negotiate with the EU now in these upcoming negotiations, right, they might not have that free access to the single market. And so businesses are going to be worried, and you're seeing this already, about making investments that could create jobs, you know, into the UK.
So let me ask this question. I mean, I've heard this a little bit of conversation. So currently, there are the ways that they do business with each other, which are part of the European Union. After the UK leaves, that they're going to have to renegotiate the terms of those trade relationships, those economic relationships, and kind of enter into unilateral ones with between the UK and the European Union?
Yeah, look, one of the most striking things about this whole Brexit, I'll call it a debacle, right?
Right.
Or debacle, is that the Leave campaign, which won, right, had really no plan in place.
Boy, that sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, no plan in place for what would happen after they won and after the UK leaves. They just said, let's leave and work out the details later, and they made a lot of false promises about what that future might look like. And so, yeah, the big question is 44% of British exports go to the EU, right?
Okay.
And so that common market of the EU, the single market, is crucial for the British economy. And so the question is, you know, can they retain untrammeled access to that common market? And the problem there is that there are some countries in Europe that have gained free access into the single market without being in the EU. Norway is one example, right?
Right.
They negotiated this deal. But in that model, the Norwegian model, we'll call it, right?
Right.
In exchange for getting access to the common market, Norway has to allow free movement of people from EU into Norway.
Ah.
It has to pay into the EU budget. It has to follow all EU rules and regulations that it has no vote over. And you see, those are all things that the Leave campaign promised they'd be getting rid of: free movement, EU rules, budget contributions. So it would be a very bitter pill to swallow to say, well, it's going to be exactly as before, except we no longer have a voice in Brussels.
You know, Professor Kellerman, you know, I guess my very non-academic way of saying it, there's no free lunch. In other words, I got to imagine that the EU isn't, you know, throwing up a lot of kudos to the United Kingdom for the vote that they took. And I got to believe that, you know, it might not even be in their best economic interest, but I got to believe they're going to want to get a little even in the treaties they would negotiate with the UK, because they don't want everybody else to leave.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the central tension for the EU in thinking about its approach to these negotiations is that, as you said, on the one hand, they can't give the UK a sweetheart deal or something. They can't give them a free lunch, and they won't, first, because it's not in their interest to do so, but secondly, because it would encourage other states to try to leave and get a deal of their own where they get the benefits and none of the responsibilities. But on the other hand, they don't want to be too harsh on the UK and totally lock them out of trade with Europe or something, or impose really high restrictions, because, you know, if that really damages the British economy, causes a recession, well, that would have negative impacts on Europe itself, right? Because they're so closely tied. So they need to be tough, but not damage the UK too much.
And again, I accept your pushback before that it is more than economics that is involved in this. But at the end of the day, economics is a significant driver in how they're going to wind up negotiating the future terms, because, you know, they could be mean, but they can't hurt themselves in being mean.
Yeah, no, that's all true. And I guess what I was pushing back on before is just to, you know, to underline that the European Union is more than just the common market. It's not like NAFTA or some free trade arrangement. It is a political union. It's not a state, not quite a federation, but it's its own beast, and it's something more. And the project of integrating Europe after World War II and trying to bring peace to the continent, it was always sort of designed to use the appeal to countries and people's economic interests. Right. And making them realize they could all be better off in this relationship if they cooperated, but using that to pursue a greater goal of bringing peace and democracy to the continent. And I think, you know, frankly, the a lot of people in Britain and certainly some of the political leaders, they just didn't ever buy into that vision wholeheartedly, or let's say it was a marriage of convenience and not love. And so they wanted the economic benefits, but they always had qualms about this sort of idea of a political union.
Yeah. Hey, Professor Kellerman, thank you so much. Boy, I learned a whole lot. I know that our listeners did, and it kind of makes us better able to kind of enter into conversations. And I thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Well, it was my pleasure. Anytime.
Hey, Professor Daniel Kellerman, who teaches political science at Rutgers University, is kind of an expert on some of those European legal issues, which is so grateful that he took the time to be with us. Hey, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back in a couple of minutes on the Catholic Channel. Just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more compassionate. It will be more just. This is Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation in which we kind of look at what's going on in our world and we try to provide a prism in which we can look at some of our Catholic values and see how they impact and how they help us to think about and understand what's going on in the world around us. We just spoke about a global issue, the exit of Great Britain, the United Kingdom from the European Union, which obviously had immediate economic implications on the United States of the decrease in the stock market. Anybody who has retirement funds or other types of investments knew immediately that there was an impact. Now, whether they come back and how much they come back, that's another question, but there was an immediate impact in what's going on there. So it wasn't only in Europe. And that global economy means that what happens in one place, if it's significantly large economy, is going to impact what goes on in other places. So we kind of spoke with Professor Kellerman from Rutgers about that, and I know I learned a lot about it. And we're going to now turn to the situation in the United States and kind of discuss what's going on politically in the United States, which I think is kind of appropriate as we approach the Independence Day, 4th of July weekend, to kind of look at, kind of talk about American politics, because people have drawn a connection between the vote in the United Kingdom and American political science. And I'm delighted because we're going to speak with somebody who really knows a lot about that, Nolan McCarty, who is the professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University. And I'm delighted that he's been kind of willing to share his expertise with us on Just Love. Professor McCarty, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Great. So So let's just begin right getting into it. Do you see a connection between the Brexit vote, as they're calling it, and politics that's going on in the United States today?
I think the one area where there probably is a connection is that a large factor behind the Brexit vote was a popular reaction against the political elites in Great Britain. If you look at the kind of the traditional leadership of Great Britain, the leadership of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, they both strongly supported Remain. Yet neither party was able to kind of rally their kind of rank and file voters behind Remain, and they ended up leaving. I think there's something similar in the U.S. In that whether you're looking at the Republican side with the presumptive nomination of Donald Trump as the Republican candidate, or on the Democratic side with the long slog that Hillary Clinton had to go through to wrestle the nomination away from someone who had only been a Democrat for a few months, suggests that the leadership of both parties is not, the establishment, the leadership, whatever, is not very popular among the rank and file voters. The voters have some discontent. They don't feel like the traditional political leadership is addressing them effectively, and they're willing to turn to unusual options, whether that's leaving the European Union and Britain, or nominating Donald Trump and the U.S., or supporting a recently socialist candidate in the Democratic primary.
Professor McCarthy, I remember. It seems to me that this is kind of even a more extreme version of what kind of was always the rule in politics. When in doubt, throw the bums out. This seems to be kind of even more extreme than that.
That's right. I mean, the traditional when in doubt, throw the bums out was in a world in which partisanship wasn't very strong. So if the Democrats were in power, and they were ineffective, many Democratic voters with in an era with less partisanship were willing to support throwing them out and giving the Republicans a try. One of the things we have now is that with, intense partisanship, you can't just simply throw Democratic bums out and replace them with Republicans. I mean, many voters, dislike the other party's bums as much as their own bums. And so they're they don't have a place to turn other than these kind of unorthodox candidacies in the form of, Senator Sanders and Mr. Trump. So I think there's something new, but I think it's in this era of kind of intense partisanship where the disconnects can't be resolved simply by replacing one party with another, because most voters intensely dislike the party that they don't affiliate with, and so they're not willing to give them a chance. They feel like they need to blow up their own party, overturn the leadership of their own party in order to get what they want.
Well, isn't that borne out by what everybody has been touting, is that right now we have a candidate on the Republican side, on the Democratic side, who have the greatest or the highest dislike unfavorability ratings of kind of all times of people who have been nominated by major parties. It's ironic that we have that, and I think that is one indicator of the reality that you're pointing out.
I think that's right. So a lot of the unpopularity, Secretary Clinton comes from Republicans who were not going to like her for a variety of reasons, in addition to her partisanship and a large degree of the dislike for, Mr. Trump is from, Democrats who oppose him on partisanship. But what's quite remarkable is that the partisans of each party don't like their own candidates all that much either. And I think it kind of shows that voters feel somewhat alienated from the party leadership. I mean, it's quite a situation where you can imagine the you know, the only candidate that Secretary Clinton could beat is Donald Trump, and the only candidate that Donald Trump could beat is Secretary Clinton, given the high levels of unpopularity of both those candidates.
It certainly is a situation which is, you know, leaves, I think, a lot of us kind of shaking our heads. We're speaking with Professor Nolan McCarty, who teaches at Princeton University, Politics and Public Affairs. Do you have any idea why you think we're in this situation in the United States at the moment? I mean, I'm sure that it's multifaceted, but give us some of your thoughts on how do we get here and, you know, ultimately, a little bit later in our conversation, I'm going to ask, is there any way out of it? But how do we get here?
I think it's been a very long process of getting here. You know, my academic specialty is understanding the polarization of American politics. And if you kind of go back to where I think the origins are, it goes back to the late 1970s and is a process that's proceeded and accelerated through the past 35 years. So I think we're at kind of peak, maybe hopefully it's peak polarization, but I think we're at a culmination of a process that's been going on for quite some time.
Is there anything that you kind of talked about the late 70s? Is there a particular event, situation, or what happened at that time that you would kind of say is the start of this trend?
I think there's a couple. I think there's a couple of things. I don't think a one-off singular events have played much of a role, although they've kind of contributed and thrown fuel on the fire. I think ultimately it comes down to two factors. One is that if you look at the post-war United States, we had a very centrist politics, lots of bipartisanship on both sides, kind of a willingness to cross the aisle. You know, high degrees of trust across party lines, a general consensus around a welfare state and an activist government. At the same time, the economy was booming, growing very fast, and it was a pretty shared prosperity. The part about the shared prosperity and the kind of booming economy ended in the 1970s, and it kind of called into question the kind of political policy consensus in the United States toward, you know, a welfare state and activist government.
Did we have a recession or something in that time?
The 1970s were a particularly poor economic period. It wasn't simply a recession, but it was high inflation. It was a response to the oil shocks of the 1970s, somewhat of a response to the kind of urban unrest of the late 60s and early 70s.
I mean, is that when we were seeing, is that the period of time when we were seeing those 16-17% returns on interest rates and stuff like that?
That's correct, yeah. Okay. So in 1981, you know, you would go to the bank, get a mortgage promising to pay 16% interest on that mortgage, but you were willing to do that because inflation was so high. The unique thing about the 1970s was that it was the combination of inflation and recession, something that kind of orthodox economic theory had a difficult time explaining, which helped kind of undermine kind of Keynesian economics, the welfare state, and so forth. So that was one. That was one important factor. Another related factor is the United States over the past 40 years has become much more diverse society. It's become more diverse economically because of many of the changes we saw in the 1970s. Prosperity has not been shared. Some people, one could even argue a very large number of people have done quite well over the past 40 years, but it's not been true of everyone. Middle class wages have been either stagnant or falling, depending on which estimates you believe. So, the past 40 years have been very unequal economically. It's also been a period of kind of dramatic change in terms of the ethnic and racial diversity in society as a result of, you know, new laws in the 1960s, immigration for a variety of very good humanitarian reasons, it was opened up to much of the rest of the world, whereas it had been shut off. It's a more ethnically diverse society. Economic inequality and ethnic diversity are two things that really tend to fuel political conflict, especially when there are large numbers of, middle class white voters whose pocketbooks have not improved very much over the 4 years. I would argue that, those are the ultimate source of the Trump voters, people who both have economic grievances, but perhaps also racial and ethnic grievances because they don't view the political process as being very opening to their concerns.
So, Professor McCarthy, let me ask you. It seems to me, from a couple areas that I have a modicum of familiarity with, where we've moved what I want to call the post-fact world, that facts don't matter anymore. It's basically, I know the great political thing is, oh yes, you're entitled to your own opinion, but your own facts. But we can't agree anymore on even what's fact and what's opinion. So, let me give you my one example of this, okay? A lot of the immigration debate is talking about first we have to secure the border from Mexico, and then we can talk about potential paths to legalization or other changes. But you got to secure the border first. We have to prevent the millions of undocumented people from Mexico and Central America coming in. Well, if you look at the border crossings in the past 3 or 4 years, it's happened. The border is relatively secure, but it doesn't seem to matter in the political debate. We get these people who we're paying their salaries, who have all types of degrees, standing up there, and facts don't seem to matter. And so my question that I'm asking you more broadly than immigration is, do we live in a post-fact political environment where the only thing that matters is opinion?
Actually, on your example, I think it's actually worse than that. There have actually been millions of border crossings. They've just been back toward Mexico over the past 3 or 4 years.
Right. Right.
I think that's right. There has been a tendency to kind of politicize facts. There's been kind of a denigration of academic expertise, a large kind of popular skepticism.
Well, that's why we have you here, because you're going to restore academic integrity.
That's right. There are certain shows I could go on a particular cable network where I would be derisively referred to as professor throughout the interview. I won't say which show that is.
Okay. All right.
But I think that's right, and it's not it's not entirely a function of the right wing's rejection of facts. There's a lot of
I can say
information about genetic modified crops.
I'll tell you.
It's just there is just something about our contemporary culture in which the entire political process has tried to separate itself out.
So let me ask you the question.
I mean, just distrust them.
One of the things that I think I find, and so I want to bounce this off you for your reaction, is we have so much now unvetted media where you can post it, and if you post it, it becomes a fact.
I think one of the big changes, although. Obviously has to do with social media. Prior to social media, for all its all its problems and flaws, traditional media was an important gatekeeper for facts and expertise. The traditional journalist's job is really to try to find out what the facts are, to talk to people on both sides and make an assessment about where the truth lies. Now, they may not always succeed in that. There might be certain biases, and that they don't always get it right. But your observation about social media is right in that it kind of removes traditional journalism as a gatekeeper and presents, you know, a public space full of factish information for which it's very, very hard for the normal person to parse out what is true and what is false. And that's complicated by this lack of trust and expertise in elites.
Yep.
Because, you know, I could say that's wrong. I mean, it's, you and I both agree that the immigration numbers are highly distorted in these debates. But there's plenty of stuff on the Internet suggesting otherwise. And people might just ask, why should I believe you instead of, you know, what I read? What I read on the internet.
You know, it's, I got to tell you, what one of the things I just did, you know, very, very recently, because for years, one of the places, and I usually look at headlines in the morning, just from a variety of different sources, and one of the places I always used to, I still do, look at is Huffington Post, because I thought, you know, find out what was going on in the world. Well, you know, in the past year or so, and maybe I just have not been attentive, I've been noticing the incredible, what I think, is certain slant to what's presented there. So I kind of look, and now I also look each day on this thing called the Daily Caller, which, let me tell you, when you look at the same story on both of those, you don't know what you're looking at. It's kind of like, you know, who knows? Because everybody's got their own slant, and you got to try to figure out what the reality is in the middle of it. And I think that's one of the things that's contributing to kind of the what's going on in the country now. And I don't know, you got any solution for this?
Well, I don't have a solution, but I think the problem you identify with the comparison of Huffington Post and Daily Caller is that those are two outlets that have the appearances of being more or less traditional media,
right,
even though they aren't. There are often places where people with a particular point of view know that they're, you know, have the opportunity to publish opinion pieces and so forth. And they're, you know, they're not, you know, the editorial decisions are not up to the same standards as kind of traditional media.
Right.
I think it would be very important as a solution, at least to this particular aspect of the problem, you know, would be ways of kind of strengthening traditional media, having ways in which, you know, the role of, you know, the major media outlets in settling, maybe not settling, but adjudicating debates about facts and opinions could be strengthened. It's really an economic problem, I think, for journalism.
I mean,
the resources available for traditional newspapers have been declining as subscriptions decline. They haven't quite figured out how to make money in the new environment. So I think there might be other models. For newspapers, I am employed by a $16 billion endowed institution that, you know, takes losses for the most part. I don't sell my papers or books at a profit. It would be great if people would start endowing newspapers.
Not a bad idea. I like it.
You know, I'm not going to give any of Princeton's endowment for that. I'm allowed to, but If newspapers you know could operate under the model of the research university, I think it could go a long way toward,
I like that.
At least dealing with this particular aspect of the problem.
Hey, listen, Professor McCarty, you've been so generous with your time, and I'm just so appreciative. And I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners is. So thank you so much for sharing your insights, your perspective with us on Just Love. And have a very, very good Independence Day, 4th of July weekend.
Great. Great. Thank you. You too.
Thank you. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more compassionate and it will be more just. You know, as we come to the close of our show, as we approach the 4th of July Independence Day weekend, I do think it's an important time for us as Catholics, for us as Christians, for everybody in the country to kind of reflect a little bit upon the great gifts that God has bestowed upon us as a nation, and without being a messenger of doom and gloom, to realize that there are some very, very serious issues that we are facing as a country, and that we need to do our part to make sure that we try to be part of the solution. The fact, it is not good when we have two candidates from major parties that are incredibly disliked, incredibly judged unfavorably by so many people. That's not what should be going on. And I'm not saying one way or the other whether those opinions are just or unjust or fair. All I'm saying is that's the reality. And the fact that that's what we're dealing with this 4th of July weekend is very, very real. When we have a political situation in which people shout at each other rather than try to reason together and to come to compromise, that's not good for our political system. It's not good for the common good. That's not what we mean by our social teaching of participation and community and solidarity. And lest we think that that is very, very unimportant, it was so many times in the past, a number of times in the past number of years, when we almost economically defaulted as a country because we couldn't realize how we were going to deal with our legitimate debt services, because it was being held hostage in a variety of ways as to what we needed to do about that. And that is not a good thing. What is also kind of very, very heartening, it seems to me, is the fact that still, despite all our problems, that still we are one of the countries, if not the leading country in the world, in which people from other places want to come with their dreams, with their aspirations. And I have to tell you that recently I was at a situation in which there were a number of people from foreign countries, from a variety of countries. And boy, their commitment to this country, their commitment to the values of freedom, of economic growth, of hard work, was just so incredibly apparent. And so I would suggest that as we kind of go into this 4th of July weekend, we'd need to do a little bit of self-examination. I'm not saying self-examination of kind of what our political opinions is, all of those things, but the way that I as an individual participate in the political life of this nation. Do I participate in neighborhood associations? Do I participate in tenant associations? What is it that I do to kind of build up the commonality of my neighbors and myself, even if I have a disagreement with them? And can I express that disagreement in a way that isn't vitriolic, isn't angry, but is trying to say, hey, these are my deep beliefs. You may be different, but that's what I hold. And can I try to understand what the other person is saying? And I think if we do that, we will be faithful to what we celebrate this weekend, our independence, but our mutual solidarity with one another. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.